Okay, so here we are in Liverpool Hope University, another week, and we've got an artist in speaking with us today. We've got Jay Wheeler, who's an artist in Liverpool. He's a street artist, so any of you who are familiar with the streets of Liverpool, you may have seen a very generous stenciled love, the word love, dotted all around the city in lots of different places. And that's just in one city. And now I believe that actually that love stencil or tag, I think you call it.
Love tag.
Love tag has gone international. So we've got Jay here, and Jay's going to talk to us a little bit about his background, how he's become a street artist, and what's the intention behind his work as a street artist. So Jay, thanks so much for coming along.
Thank you very much for inviting me along. I really appreciate it, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story. So from the beginning,
great.
You know, as a young child, around 4 or 5 years of age, myself and my younger brother, who's just like a year younger than I am, we were beaten like on a regular basis, almost like a daily basis. And we were beaten with quite a thick stick, and we would get beaten for doing nothing, you know. And this went on from around the age of 4 till at least I was 15 years of age. And I found that due to the violence that was inflicted on me as a young boy, I went on to junior school. And for my term of junior school, I was bullied. So I was not only bullied and beaten at home, I was also bullied at school. Now, the knock-on effect of that is whenever I was struggling in a lesson in school, I wouldn't be the one that would put my hand up and say, I don't understand it, can you explain to me? Because, you know, you at that time, and I'm pretty sure it's still the same now, where children are almost scared to put their hand up because they don't understand something, because they don't want to be made a fool of, because, you know, they get that at home and stuff. And that I always said that those beatings knocked the confidence out of me at a very early age. So my education was, it was really poor, because I struggled with holding that information, absorbing it, and you know, taking it on board. I struggled so much, and because I was almost too scared to put my hand up to say I don't understand, you know, it my education was really poor. But I remember when I went to senior school, I decided that at that time that I wasn't going to be bullied by anybody. I was still getting beatings at home, but I decided I wasn't going to be bullied. So the first kind of person that tried to bully me in school, we had it, you know, and that was my statement to say, I'm not putting up with it. I have to put up with it at home. I got no choice, but at school I don't need to put up with it. So I started to get into fighting, and I was fighting in school. There was like a gang of us, and after school we'd hang around and we'd have fights, full on street fights with gangs from different postcodes, you know. And for me, it kind of felt like, because I'd had violence inflicted onto me from a very early age, it almost felt right for me to inflict it onto someone else.
It was just normalised for you as a kid.
Exactly, and it was very, very normalised. Now, that in turn, with the gang fighting, that in turn then led to getting arrested, going to court. I I did fines, you know, I had the fines, I had community service, and I still wasn't listening to the relevant people. I still had this attitude of, it's what I know. Mm. Fighting is all I know. And I got involved in one gang fight that was from a different town, and it was a full on battle in the street. And my thing was to punch, you know. And I got arrested, went to court, all the rest of it. But this time when I went to court, the judge had said, can't give you fines because it has no effect on you. Can't give you community service because that has no effect on you. So he said, I'm going to sentence you to, I think it was like 17 months, and I had to do at least 12 months. And I knew then in that dock, right, as soon as he said, I'm sentencing you to 17 months, for a few seconds, I had tears running down my eyes. And I was like, and the reason I had tears running down my eyes was because I was still some, I think I was like, just short of 17 or 17. And realization had set in right there and then. And I was like, well, and then when he said to take him down, so I got to, from the top of the stairs to the bottom of those stairs, no more tears, because I'd said to myself, right, now I'm going to go to an environment where you have to have eyes in the back of your head, and you've got to bring that knowledge that I learned from the streets, mm-hmm. basically. And I might have to use it because I'm going to be up against all sorts, you know. And I remember for the first couple of days, I had to spend time on a young offenders transit wing in Winston Green prison. And that was just a scary environment because, you know, I could see full-blown men, you know.
Right.
It's not, you got kids on your wing, but you're also interacting with the men, the, you know. And that for me was quite daunting and quite scary. And then a few days later, they shipped me out to a Young Offenders Institute called Onley, which is based in Warwickshire. I'm not sure if it's still there now, but they shipped me there. And it was solid 12 months there. So I was like, okay, just need to keep my head down. It's as simple as that. And I adjusted to life in the Young Offenders prison. I adjusted to it. And I only had one fight in there. And I'm, you know, I made that sound like, but for me, like, I got on with Betty on the wing, and I kind of got on with the screws as well. And I didn't bring no drama to anybody or anything. But there was one guy that was from the same town as me, Wolverhampton. And we were in this, my first job was working in the woodworking department. And this guy was in there. And he was kind of bad-mouthing one of my really, really good friends. And I remember saying, you know, if he was here now, like that, you wouldn't even be saying this rubbish. And then he kind of kicked off. And then I went, right, okay. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, but I can't I?
Cause yeah, you can
take it out if it, you know. Yeah. But what I did was I walked to the other end of the woodworking department, picked up a plank of wood, and as I'm walking up to him, he's saying, you know, yeah, he's laughing at it. And I just put it around his head. And then within seconds, the alarm had gone off and other screws had come over and they rush you and they bend you up and all that. And then they take you down to the block and took me down to the block. And then on the evening, the governor came to see me and he was like, what's it all about? And I said, it was just a misunderstanding, that's all. Because there's certain rules in young offenders and prisons that, you know, you just, they're unwritten rules that you just don't do. So, I was like, well, it's just a misunderstanding, that's all. And then they left me there for the night, brought me back on the wing the next day. And one of the screws had said to me, you know, well in, because he did everybody's head in. So it was kind of like I did everybody a favour, you know.
Right.
And then I remember, when I was in the Young Offenders, my mum never wrote to me. I wrote to her a couple of times, but she never wrote to me, nothing like that. And none of my friends came and saw me when I was in the Young Offenders either. And the day came when I was leaving to get discharged. And I'm walking, I'm being escorted by the same screw that had said, well done for, you know. And we're walking down this path to, like, the part where you physically get out. And he said to me, he says, you know, let's not see you in here again. And I looked him in the eye and I said to him, I'm never coming back to a place like this ever again. It wasn't, like I said, I adjusted to my surroundings. Mm. I had to, and that's what I did. And I had to bring my A game to the table. But what really did it for me was having my freedom taken away from me. You can't get up and go somewhere. Mm. You know, in Stevie Street, we take that for granted, you know. But in prison, there's only so far you can escape to. Mm. And that's literally to your door, to your cell, you know. And it was just something that really ate away at me. And so I came home and I made the choice of, I went and saw my friends from before I went away.
Right, like part of the gang that you've been,
But I basically said, it's not for me no more, because none of them had gone to prison. None of them were all still keen to do what they were doing. And I'd experienced that. So I was like, I'm out, you know, I'm just not, I need to get my head skipped. And, you know, again, I'm just going to flip back to my childhood. My favourite TV show was The A-Team because, you know, in 1983, and I was allowed an hour a week to watch that programme without getting beaten. Mm-hmm. So that TV show also inspired me to want to join the army. So when I came out of prison, I was like, you know what? What do I need to do? So I went to the careers office, army careers office, and I said, you know, I want to join the army, but I've just come out of Young Offenders. And they went, right, you can't apply for like 5 years. So you've basically got to get your head down, stay out of trouble for 5 years. And because it was only fighting related, that you know, we'll take you on. So then for those 5 years, I walked out of that careers office and I was like, everything that I knew has to change. Mm. And I kept my head down. I did several different jobs over that five-year period. But as soon as that five-year period came up, I went straight to the careers office, explained. I said, look, I was here 5 years ago, blah, 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 boom, okay. Set me away in a 24-hour selection just to see, to learn a bit about the army and all the rest of it. And that was, I think that was in somewhere in the other side of Birmingham. And I went there 24 hours and we did a lot of lessons about, you know, conduct of a soldier and things like that. And we also did like a run. So we were also assessed on that run. And the next day came and they went, so-and-so, you failed. So-and-so, you failed. Wheeler, you've passed. Boom. So Ivo went back to the careers office and they were like, yeah, brilliant. You've gone for your 24. Now we need to send you off to basic training. So it was literally like, it went, right, okay, before we send you off to basic training, you've got to sign the oath of allegiance. So bring your family, bring your friends, you know, it's a proud moment. And I went back and I said to my mum, right, I'm joining the army. I've got to sign the oath of allegiance tomorrow. will you come and watch me Sunday after religious? And whenever I used to say to my mum, even as a child, I'd say, you know, like, I was in the choir when I was in junior school, and I'd, every Christmas I'd say, you know, will you come and watch me in the choir? And, she'd always say, yeah, I'll see. And whenever she said that, meant she had no intention. And one year, my final year in junior school in the choir, and my own teacher drove up to where we lived and somehow persuaded her to come in, you know. And so she's never supportive whatsoever since day one. And I turned up. There was three of us signing the oath of allegiance that day, like their families and stuff, and I'm now on my own. And I signed my oath of allegiance, accepted the Queen's shilling. And I knew then that this was now going to be that change that I have wanted and needed. And like I said, I did several jobs in between, and then I did the 24-hour section. Then I went off to do my basic training. And I remember saying to my mum, I was like, the night before, I remember walking around where I grew up, because I think that evening when I did that, I knew that I'm never coming back to this place, mm-hmm. and that if my life is going to change, it's got to do with me, you know.
So did you see the army kind of as a substitute family for you?
Very much a family, full stop. Yeah. I went off and I said, you know, I'm leaving now. And she went, yeah, see you in about 2 weeks, right? Which, again, was that type of attitude. And basic training was 3.5 months. And, again, when we had certain lessons in basic training, classroom lessons, I struggled because, I struggled to absorb that information. Really struggled. But that's theory wise, but practical wise, like my fitness was on the ball. Mm-hmm. When we were doing field exercises out on the ground, you know, I'd complete the tasks. And, you know, I think in civilian businesses, it's called, summit building?
Team building,
you know. Yeah. So the army are like, that's at the forefront, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do where your family and friends can come and watch you pass out in your uniform and all this kind of stuff. You have to rehearse this passing out parade like every day for like 4 weeks because no one can get it wrong, you know. It was a week before the actual passing out parade. We'd just finished a drill lesson. And the squadron leader had come out to us and he said, right, in basic training, we have awards at the end of the training. There are only like 5 awards. One of them is best PT, so best physical training. Best improved recruits. Best shot with your rifle. Four actually, and the main one is best recruit, right? Mm. So I know that I struggled with using the rifle, and you know, and when we used to do ranges, I couldn't hit a barn door. But every time they would educate me, I listened, and I did exactly what. And so over a period of time, my skills got better. So I thought. Because you've got to have a little bit of confidence. I thought, maybe I wonder if I got, like, the best shot. And best shot, he read out all these, the awards and got the best shot. And he said so-and-so. And I was like, all right, cool, never mind. I was fine with it. And he went, and then the main one is best recruit. And it goes to Trooper Wheeler. So, at that moment, and I've done it ever since, but at that moment, I was overjoyed, and you know, and I remember saying to my troop corporal, and I was like, well, best recruit. I said, like, I was rubbish in some of them lessons and things like that. He said, look, the army is not. He said, you can learn that through experience. He says, but what we saw was that when we gave everyone a task, if you were struggling, and I'd finish my task, I would just get up and help you to finish your task. And that's what the army's about.
Okay, so one of the songs that you are very passionate about and means something to you is All Together Now.
Yeah.
So we'll have a little listen to that.
Again, it's about working as a team, not as an individual. At the time, I didn't realise that until he pointed it out. And he was like, you know, and we've watched you on this exercise. And I was like, wow, my God. And they said, we'll notify your family. We'll tell them that you've won the Best Recruit Award and to come to the Passing Out Parade. The morning now, the Passing Out Parade, we're on the parade, on the parade square. And we're at one end and the family and friends are at the other end and I'm standing at attention and I'm looking over and I'm like, I can't see. Called out all these awards, did all that, and then they went Bishop Cruise. And my troop sergeant said, you know, his words, can I swear?
Yeah, you can.
His words were, don't fuck it up, Wheeler. Because I had to step out of the squadron and march all around this massive parade square, side on to all the family and the colonel, right? So I was like, God, please don't fuck this up, Jay, because it'd be all over. But I did it, and as I'm facing the colonel, I could see, and he handed me they handed you this big, massive award trophy thing, right? Right. But half an hour later, they take that off you, and they give you this smaller one, that, you know. So, and you're smiling, you're having photos with this. And then on the way, and I'd realised then she wasn't there, right? So on the way back to the parade, back to my marching around, back to join my squadron, and I've done this ever since, I put my middle finger up to my mum, because she said to me, I'll see you in 2 weeks, you'll never do it, you'll never do that. I not only completed basic training, I walked away with the Best Recruit Award, which is a top award. That was put in the Wolverhampton Express and Star in the local paper and stuff, so she would have seen that. But that was enough for me. And then I never went back to Wolverhampton. I stayed at one of my friends who I was in base training with, stayed with him, and then next thing I know, I did my phase two training, which was, I joined the Royal Armoured Corps, which is aka the cavalry. So when I joined the regiment, which was Queen's Royal Hussars, I joined them, and we had Challenger 1 main battle tank. And then throughout my career, we then moved on to the main battle tank, Challenger 2. And I remember my first operational tour was Kosovo, and it was I joined in 97, and my first operational tour was in 1999, and that was Kosovo. And I wrote a letter to my mum, and I said, look, you know, I just want you to be proud of what I'm doing. This is what I've been doing so far, and I'm enjoying it, and I never got anything back. And then I decided on that tour that I can either keep trying and not get anything back, or I can just finally focus on myself and what do I want. And I was, you know, I want a career in the army. People always say, even well before joining the army is like a massive family. And I learned everything about family fundamentals through the army. Simple as that. If I did something wrong, I'd get shouted at. And then 10 minutes later, you'd have a pint together in the naffy or something. And that's how, you know, if you do something wrong, own up to it. If you don't understand what you've done wrong, then ask that person to explain it. You know, and that's what it's all about. It's about listening and all the rest of it. And that, the army, my regiment, became my family. When we came back from Kosovo, we had inter-squadron boxing. So I was like, I won't mind doing some of that. Certain individuals from the squadron were picked for the B squadron boxing team. And the training was about 3 months, but it was solid. Like we didn't have to do any regimental duties. It was all fitness, regime. Like you had a certain diet that you could eat, you know.
Like a professional athlete.
Proper, yeah, proper. And it was solid. And I remember, like, this is probably about 4 weeks to go before the actual boxing tournament. And I just gave up in the gym. I was like, physically, absolutely done it. So the PTI said, go on, go back to your squadron. And in between, walking from the gym to the squadron, my squadron office, the PTI had phoned my squadron sergeant major, who's like the boss, you know, and said, he's flaked it. So I came in, he went, yeah, come on. He says, what's the problem? I said, I physically can't do it, you know, sir. Like, it's really taking it out of me. And he was like, look, this is your opportunity to be a warrior and to get away with it. And I stood there and I was like, all them fights that I did as a kid, what did I prove? I didn't prove nothing. I didn't prove nothing when I was getting into them fights as a kid. I didn't prove nothing by going to Young Offenders Institute. I wasn't ashamed of it, but all that happened for no reason. I didn't have to do none of that, you know? And I think the army made me realise that, A, communicate. The army taught me how to communicate. Mm-hmm. I couldn't communicate. I didn't know how to communicate before. And the army taught me how to communicate, which meant that I was in, put in certain situations when I served in Iraq and in Afghanistan where your communication skills are vital, because you can prevent something bad from really happening. And I'd finesse that over a period of time, you know. 15 years I did in the army. And when you look back and you go, your mum said, oh yeah, we'll see, I'll see you in 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Yeah. And every award that I achieved, every medal that I achieved, I stuck my middle finger up to her, to my mum. And I, my second tour of Iraq, I was blessed and I was given the Brigadier's Commendation. And that was because I was teaching Iraqi army soldiers basic British military skills. And I had to do that 3 months out of the 7. And I did it. No experience in teaching or anything like that, but I did it. And the reason I got away with it, or I did it so well, was because every intake that I would have, like in the first one, I said to the interpreter, right, what's the number one song in Iraq at the minute, you know? And he went, oh, it's this song called blah, blah, blah. And I went, well, just teach me the chorus. So he taught me the chorus. We're in this massive big tent, which was our classroom. I had like a squadron worth of Iraqi soldiers who all thought I was from Iran because of my complexion. And I was like, I'm British soldier, mate. And the song was, you're Magna Sadne. So then they're all sitting there waiting for some, and I just went, you're Magna Sadne. And then they all started going off and jumping and shouting. And I was like, now I've got their attention. So then in the mornings, I would do theory with them. And then in the afternoons, I'd take them outside and we'd do practicals. So my squadron leader, there was an incident that, not just that, but there was an incident where we were travelling from the northern area of Iraq to the southern Iraq. And it was quite a long convoy. And every time you stop, you have to get out and do what's called the 5 and 20 meters check, which as soon as you get out, you check, because you're checking for IDs, you're checking for sensors, you're checking for all that. And we got out, we had to stop, we had to get out. And I was straight away seeing a UXO, which is unexploded ordnance. And I just shouted, you know, still. It's what you say. And I shouted, still. And everyone just froze. And I says, UXOs, we need to get back on. Got back on the yard standing. So that also went towards my Brigadier's commendation. So, you know, for me, I'd come into my own as a soldier on my second tour of Iraq. But Afghanistan finished me off.
So you're in Kosovo, you're in
I did two tours Iran, of Kosovo, two Iraq.
To Iraq, and then?
And then Afghanistan.
And then Afghanistan. Right.
And my time in Afghanistan, I was put in the green zone, which is like, it's the roughest part you can ever go to. Like, it's Taliban owned and all of that. And they sent me out to the green zone, because my job in Afghanistan was ISTAR, which was intelligence, surveillance, targeting, and recognition. So I had to go out on a patrol, and I would have to think, where would I put an IED if I was the Taliban?
Right.
You have to think like that. And on a daily basis, we get attacked on a daily basis, without a shadow of a doubt. But my time out there, 7 months, I just saw too many of our own boys and girls get blown up. I saw soldiers come apart in a plume of dust, just limbs coming out of the dust. There was one where we got ambushed, and one of the guys had been shot, and it literally just above his, just below his abdomen, right? and his intestines were hanging out. And we called in the chopper, but the chopper was coming all the way from Camp Bastion, which was like a 10-minute air flight, easy time. And we had 10 minutes to try and sustain that injury. And he was awake. His eyes were open. The chopper came. We put him on the chopper. Died. The chopper hadn't even lifted off the ground. Died. Then we had another one where we got ambushed again by the Taliban. And we were fighting out of like irrigation ditches, which is their sewage system. So you're standing and fighting in the middle of a sewage system. And my friend and my colleague, my friend, my brother, Zach, he lost his life. We got ambushed. And we have these personal radios that we can communicate with each other within that team. And we were getting shot at. The bullets were coming all over. It was like something you'd see in like a Hollywood film, you know. But I could hear gargling. And Zach was somewhere like 3 or 4 down from where I was. And then I saw Zach and he fell and that was it. He'd gone, you know. I seen British soldiers get blew up and shot, but these were British soldiers that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But Zach was in it with us in that green zone, you know, and it was crazy because that was my last Christmas. We had Christmas out there, and Zach didn't lose his life until the January, and we were out there till the March of the next year. And I remember, like, Christmas Day, the Taliban, just before Christmas Day, sometimes, when, a lot of the time in Afghanistan, you hear these big bangs, and some of them would be what we call own goals, so where the Taliban are laying an IED and they blow themselves up by mistake, so we call it own goal. So one of these guys, right, one of these Taliban, was fixing up an IED to blow us up, but blew himself up. So then the Taliban got in touch with our base and said, we're burying the guy, ceasefire, like a truce for this 24 hours. So the British Army said, yeah, we'll give you a truce, you know, you bury you. Christmas Day, the next day, they're shooting us and everything. And it, you know, the politics at that time in Afghanistan was absolutely absurd. But Christmas Day, in between getting shot at, the main chef, like from Camp Bastion, he flew out to us and he brought us steak and chips. And what the public do when you're away in Operation Two, they call it shoebox appeal. And you know, you put like chucky bars in there and lots of little, yeah. And well, at Christmas, if you're out there at Christmas, like the public go nuts, like they send you everything. And so he came out to us, gave us steak and chips, and we had about 4 or 5 of these shoe boxes each, you know. And I remember we were sitting just outside our tent after dinner and all that. And I said to the lads, and I was like, you know what, none of us want to be here. Like, if we could be somewhere else, I'm pretty sure we would be. I said, but it's an honour to spend Christmas Day in Afghanistan, but with these people.
Great stuff. And you're a massive fan of the A-Team and had a huge impact on your life and kind of informed lots of the more artistic side of you. And we listen to that theme tune now.
then a couple of weeks later, we lost Zach. So I, within a month or so after that, I'd ended two, I'd finished my duty, and I flew back to the UK like a couple of days later, and I came home, and I was sitting on my couch, and I said to myself, from when I was a young boy to the time in the army, I'd seen hate at its worst, and I'd seen anger at its worst. And I became depressed, and I became suicidal. I thought about my life at that point, and I hadn't even seen a lot of love. Like, I seen the love in my regiment, you know, but I hadn't seen a lot of love, and I just thought, you know what, I don't want to be a part of this world. I do not want to be a part of. I've been to the other end, and that other end, it's not a nice place, and I couldn't deal with it. I could not deal with it. I was an experienced soldier at that stage in my life. I could not deal with what I experienced in Afghanistan. So then I remember going over to the church just here, and I went into the church, and there was nobody in there, and I started talking to God and saying, I need you to come to me because I'm struggling here, and I'm in a place that I just do not know in my head. And that same night, I took my first overdose with the intention of not waking up. I actually, when after I took the overdose, I prayed to God, and I asked him for me not to wake up. I was happy to just not wake up. After that, because my friend, like, I had a really good friend, and this is quite important when it comes to mental health. But, you know, people say, you know, look out for your friend. If someone's not right, or you just, you know, have a think about it. And she'd done that. She obviously saw something, and showed concern. It's just my friend, you know. But between 2000 and I got medically discharged from the army in 2013. From 2013 to 2015. I tried five times to end my life, which is quite, and that, you know, that consisted of pills, overdoses, my wrists, and I tried to hang myself. And after my first attempt on my life, I was admitted to a psychiatric hospital here in Liverpool, and that was quite scary and quite daunting, because you have to live amongst other people, mental illnesses, which mental illness goes from zero to, you know, to the top of the mark. So I found that quite difficult. They'd released me after a couple of months. They sent me back home. And I did the same thing again. But there was once when I tried to hang myself. The police... All I know is that when the police... All I heard, right, was banging on my door initially. But then I didn't hear nothing else. And I don't remember anything else apart from... I woke up as this police officer had his hands around the noose. So as he's pulling this noose to lever it out, I'm coming back to life type thing. And then they sectioned me, which I've never been. The other admissions, they were classed as voluntary, but this one was like a section, you know. So they sectioned me. When I was in hospital that time, I was encouraged to go to the OT department, the occupational therapy department, and do art. So I was like, I'm not going to do art. I'm not doing any of that. Like, I don't even want to be here. I don't want to be here. And I don't want to be here, you know. And because I was there for a couple of months, they keep badgering me every day, you know. So I'm like, you know, come down to the OT department and do some artwork. Then it got to a stage where I was like, yeah, well, I'll just go down, you know. And I was in there, and the guy said, you know, what do you want to do? And because I got to a stage going to different hospitals, I was like, I got tired of being asked the same questions every day, like, how are you today? Are you okay today? And in the end, it done me head in. So I was like, well, what I'm going to do, I'll do some artwork, but I'll use my own feelings, my emotions, how I'm feeling now, and I'm going to describe it through art. So I started doing that. And my artwork in the beginning was very dark, and it was very thought-provoking. My artwork still to this day is still very thought-provoking, but back then it was really dark, and it was like, it's just horrible. And then I was like, oh, maybe I just need to base my artwork on something. So then, you know, God willing, I came up with the idea of, well, why don't I just base everything, my artwork, on the word love? Because for me, it felt that love had taken a back seat in society, you know, like people were more concerned about not having a bottle of milk in the fridge or, you know, it just felt like, I never experienced it as a child. In the army, yeah, I experienced some type of love, you know.
Sense of belonging and
sense of belonging and being made to feel like you're just as special as that person there. Do you know what I mean? And we all kind of need that. So I decided to base it on the word love. And
so did you make your first stencil then?
I said to the woodworking staff member, I said to him, I said, can you make me a stencil that says the word love? And he went, yeah, of course we can. And I says, we'll do that now for you. And he made me this stencil. And so what I did at first was I would paint in between the letters on the stencil, you know, lift the stencil away, and there you got the word love. And then when I was due to leave hospital, I said to him, I said, look, can you do me a new stencil? But one that doesn't come with parts, because that first stencil, like the old centerpiece, I had to like carry it around, stick it on the wall, and you know, so it didn't make sense. And I said, you know, can you make me one that I can just go spade on and be gone? And he went, yeah, and he did it. Now, when I left hospital, for the next 6 weeks, you have to go back every day, every weekday, and it's part of your still ongoing, you know, treatment. So what I did, I went into town, I bought myself a long kind of canvas, but got myself some spray paint, and I went home, and this white long canvas in the centre, put the stencil in, I sprayed it red, took the stencil away, love. That's all it said, nothing else, nothing fancy, just love. And what I did every day, I walked from here, from where I just, where I live across the road, I walked from here, and I would walk to Broad Oak Psychiatric Unit, which is over the other side of, like, just before you get on the A road for the M62.
Oh, okay, so it's a good,
you know, left by the flyover.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to walk there, and what I used to do, I used to walk against the traffic with this canvas, And people must have thought, he's completely nuts. You know, what?
With this little love written across.
Or let's see someone walking down the street with this canvas, and it's just as love. And it was once when I literally came adjacent with a bus stop, and the bus had just pulled up, and I just stood there, and I just was like that. And I wanted people, and that was my first connection about wanting people to connect with that word love. And then to ask themselves, what does that mean to you? What does it mean in your life? And that's all it was, because God had said, I'm not going to let you kill yourself, because I need you for this purpose. You know, there's a bigger plan. And that was the plan, the love. So even when I went to the hospital and the guy woodworking thing, he'd say, you do this every day. And I said, I walk here and I walk back with the same canvas. Now, when those 6 weeks were up, I was like, right, what am I going to do now? So I was like, right, I'm going to take that stencil then, and I'm going to start putting it on the streets, and let's see how it, you know, interacts with people. And I started doing that, and then I gave myself a name, because I thought I've got to give myself a street artist name. Yeah. So I came up with Love Art Global, and I thought, yeah, because love is global, and it's... I'm putting that message out through art, and it's all about love. So I started building this social media profile based on Love Art Global. And the amazing thing that has come from that is now in 2013, I won the Military Art Award, which is called the Templar Art Award, and it was given to me. I achieved it because I'd come to find art whilst I was in hospital, and then continued to do it. And my SAFA caseworker, military charity SAFA, he said, look, you know, why don't you try and do this, and you might get an award. And I left that paperwork on my breakfast table for about a month, and then one day I just went, oh, I'll fill it out, put a few photos in there, sent it off. And next thing I know, I won it. Got won it at £250 as well. I won. 2015, they give me an award for spray painting on the streets.
For
criminal damage, when you look at it. It is criminal damage what I do. And they gave me an award, 2015 Recovery Award, Merseyside Recovery Award. And then 2017, I got the Liverpool Echo nomination. But there was only two of us in the final. Fantastic. So, and my certificate was just slightly smaller than the actual winning one. So I felt like I'd won anyway.
You were a winner, yeah.
So they awarded me for what I do. And since then, I've been crowdfunded, and I've been out to Poland, Berlin, Barcelona, Dublin. I've had four exhibitions, art exhibitions so far, two in Liverpool, one in Manchester, and I had one in London in 2019. And the nice thing about what I do with the Love Tag is, people will come across it, and then they message you, and they say, oh, I've signed this Love Tag, and I really needed to see it today, or I really needed this today. You know, and it's just, first and foremost, the artwork is for me and for my therapy, right? I'm doing therapy. I'm doing trauma therapy at the moment. But all these factors are, because I'm diagnosed with PTSD and EUPD, all these factors help me to get through my days. And I would definitely say that art, you got to remember, 15 years in the army, not once did I pick up a paintbrush or a spray can, you know. Yeah. But now I realise the effect that art has on the brain when it's unwired.
Mm.
You know,
well-being.
I'm grateful to God for not allowing me to take my life. I'm grateful for God for blessing me every day, you know, with a day. Because, like I said, there was a time when I just didn't want none of it. Couldn't have cared less. I was done. But God has a wonderful way of turning things around when you really need it, you know.
And we'll have to finish there. Thanks very much today. What an amazing story. You're an inspiration. And there's no greater way than spreading love and peace. And we need more people like you in the world. So thank you so much, Jay.
God bless.
So anytime you see love around Liverpool, you know now the author, the creator of that love.
But don't report me to the police, whatever you
know. No, don't. Great stuff. Okay, and your final song is Pachelbel's Canon in D.
Yeah.
Okay, let's listen to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.